Today is Wednesday. It's March 16th, 2022. It's 2:34 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams, and this is The Mincing Rascals, a podcast we record Wednesdays now on. And you can also listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
Hey, it's John Hanson from Block Club Chicago and also of WGN Radio. Weeknights at 6 and the afternoons on Saturday.
I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the author and publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, a weekly newsletter. Also contribute to the Daily Herald periodically. And I'm basketball crazy right now. This is the greatest time of the year for a sports fan.
I think it really is. I think Thursday of this week is the best day of the year. It's the best day of the year.
We'll see about that, depending on how Michigan does. But
do they play Thursday, not Friday, Eric?
They play Thursday morning, yeah. It's Colorado State.
What are they, the Buffaloes, the Colorado State Buffaloes?
I don't care.
Well, somebody sent me a note. Congratulations to Michigan. It's the only school in the country that has a team in the NCAA men's basketball tournament, the women's basketball tournament, and something else. Eric, what was the other thing?
Well, and they made the college football playoff this year.
Yeah. So,
but they squeaked into the NCAA tournament almost undeservedly so, and I'm afraid they're going to make a quick exit. But and the magic of this tournament is you really don't know who's going to knock off with whom, especially, and there's so much talent now in college basketball, and the games are just such fun to watch.
And it's so much fun when you have an upset and you pick it and you pretend like you had the insight, you knew that 14 was going to beat that 3. But then it's also fun if your 1 or 2 goes down too, right? Like it busts your bracket a little bit, but boy, isn't it fun watching a 15 beat a 2 or something like that.
I so agree. And, you know, we all are filling out the brackets like, I don't like Memphis in this game. I don't know anything about Memphis. Everybody's kind of an expert now. Well, I really think Colorado State's got a shot at Michigan. I didn't even know they were in the tournament until I saw the brackets.
Listen, John, we're not all filling out brackets. Some of us just love the game. And I'm one of them. I played basketball. I know the game. I never have understood the brackets. I don't care about the brackets. I just love seeing wall-to-wall basketball on. I love the game.
I'm with Lisa on this. I don't fill out brackets either because it's like I just like the games are great. I record as many of them as I can, and it's terrific fun.
Well, yeah, do you guys, everything is chicken, and I'm going to put filet mignon in front of you, and you're going to go, oh, this is better. I'm a basketball guy too. Have you ever participated in a bracket? Have you been in a bracket? Isn't it so? It makes the whole experience so much more fun.
No, I don't need to wager on a game. I just watch the games. Because I know who's great and who isn't. I could probably be a on-air personality with John and call the games. I mean, I don't need to be part of a bracket. I don't need to be wagering.
You could do it for free with no money, Lisa, too.
You could do it without having to.
Oh, please.
Even a dollar. Please. Even a dollar. What do you think people are putting in their brackets? It's not their kids' college funds. It's $5. I'll tell you what. If you had $5 and you were in brackets and now suddenly you care about that 15-2 game, it would elevate your enjoyment of the tournament exponentially.
You know, John, if I made the kind of coin, John Williams, if I made the kind of coin,
$5,
$4, $5, a dollar, that would be easy to sort of throw into the wind.
Let's do a GoFundMe for Lisa, and let's see if we can scratch together $4 and get her a bracket.
Problem gamblers should call it 888.
Gambler. On a separate episode, we'll get into the fact that I was a cover for my brother to go to see his bookie when I was a kid. That's another story for another day.
Oh, well, now, see, that's a little more context to this then.
Well, that's okay. It's the 70s.
The headline in the Tribune today is cops won't face criminal charges in fatal shootings, as if that were a bad thing. Maybe you don't read it that way, as if the subtext there is that the cops got away with it again. But in the shooting deaths by police of 13-year-old Adam Toledo and 22-year-old Anthony Alvarez, I agree with the county attorney on this, guys. These were not criminal acts by the police. They were mistakes. There should have been better pursuit policies. Police should be better trained. But at 3 in the morning, through the streets and alleys of Chicago, police do not have instant slow-mo replay. I agree with Kim Fox.
You know, it was one of those things where you saw a still of a frame or you saw it in super slow motion and you really could analyze it and say, oh, my God, how did they not see that that gun was being dropped behind that fence or whatever the case may be? But I think it was a horrible circumstances that led to it. And Kim Fox did say that, at least in the case of Toledo, that the police officers giving chase helped heighten the situation, raise the stakes of the situation. Mm-hmm. But you watch those in real speed, and keep in mind some of those cameras have like some night vision effects on them. Imagine without any of that.
And you're running and your heart is pounding. Here's a quote from Kim Fox. The officers created the conditions in which the use of deadly force became necessary. So the cops made mistakes, but in the instant where they pulled the trigger, they could not know what was going to happen.
I don't think that you could say that the officer, especially in the Toledo case, created the conditions for that situation to happen. I mean, what happened was that Toledo was out with a 21-year-old friend, and the friend was firing a gun off, and the police responded to reports of shots being fired. And then Adam Toledo runs away holding the gun and after the older guy is detained. And I don't think that this means that the police need to just say, oh, well, he's running away. Someone's running away in the middle of the night down an alley with a gun in his hand that's just been fired. I think that if you ask most citizens, you'd say, I want that person arrested.
Yeah.
I don't think he knows how old Adam Toledo is as he's running away with a gun in his hand. I think you don't want police saying, oh, he's running away. What are we going to do? The law, even the policy now on foot chases, is that someone has to really pose an imminent threat. He may have just committed a crime, or you think he's about to commit a crime. He or she's about to commit a crime. And so the standard is raised. You can't just chase after someone for a traffic violation, or, you know, they didn't pay a parking ticket or something. But in the case of Adam Toledo, there was reason to believe that this kid was dangerous. He has a gun. He's running through an alley. Do we not want police to chase after him?
I think that quote was more being applied to the case of Alvarez. I mean, they knew who he was. They knew where he lived. They could have met him at home. And right. It's probable that they would not have even issued a ticket. He wouldn't have been arrested for that which they were chasing him. I mean, that was maybe a dereliction of their duty.
I haven't followed that case quite as closely, but yeah, I think that that's right. I think that in that case, they had seen him the night before. They tried to stop him and he'd run away.
That's right.
So they were going to chase him down now. And in that case, you think, yeah, we know where he is. We'll go get him later. That was not the case in the other case. So, it's one of those things where you have to ask yourself, is it a reasonable thing? Now, what happened in the Adam Toledo case was a terrible mistake, right? The kid dropped the gun as he was turning around. He was trying to throw the gun away behind the fence so that he wouldn't get caught with it. And the officer didn't see it. He had 0.8 seconds to make that decision. He made the wrong decision. I don't think anybody would argue with that. The kid had nothing in his hands when he was shot. It wasn't a criminal act. And that's what Kim Fox was saying, is a tragedy, but it wasn't a criminal act. And so I totally agree with I think what you two have said so far, which is that it was regrettable, but not a crime. And the only thing that I'm wondering, I have two questions. One is what took Kim Fox's office 50 weeks to figure this out. And also why they dropped the child endangerment charges against the 21-year-old kid who was with Toledo.
Because that's a key question. That was my big question too, because then you understand the law dictates that you have to find that the officers intended to kill both Adam Toledo and the other young man. And that is a gray area, right? When you are trained as a police officer, you are trained to shoot, they say, for the center mass. That is shooting to kill. But I think at the core of it is that these officers didn't set out to kill these two young boys. However, there are two things that are at play here. One is where the community sees, time and again, there are cases in which a young African-American man, a young Latino man is shot, no weapon. There's no even reason for them to be pulled over by the police. And then suddenly, you know, somebody's dead.
Well, they both had weapons.
They're getting lumped in. I know they did. But these cases are all getting lumped together because of these other problematic shootings.
I see.
And so you have people who are pushing back and saying, no, they should have been charged. The intent is there, and you have to sort of iron this out. What is the intent when these officers are shooting? I know it's a technicality, but it's an important one. If you're shooting for the center mass, you're shooting to kill.
Yeah, Lisa, I would say, though, that I wrote a lot of columns at the time about Officer Van Dyke shooting Laquan McDonald, which I thought was indefensible. It was basically an assassination. I think there's a real difference between a split-second bad decision that was made by Officer Stillman shooting Toledo and what Jason Van Dyke did, which was as McDonald is walking away from him, opens fire on him. I mean, this is a very different. I don't think Van Dyke.
Well, I do think I'm not saying either. That the two are the same, Eric.
Right, I understand that you're making that distinction, and I am too, which is that there's such a wide variation between the murder of George Floyd and the murder of Laquan McDonald and what happened to these other cases. They all ended in somebody dying, but what we ask our police officers to do and the situations that they find themselves in and how they react, the law, we can't, as citizens just observing this, say, lump them all together. And I take your point that they're like, they do infect one another. Like when you see something
happen, they do. This is why you have people pushing back.
I wanted to ask Eric a follow-up question. You keep on saying that it was a bad decision to shoot by Stillman. Do you mean a bad decision, Eric, or after the facts came out, it turned out to be the wrong decision? Do you get what I'm getting at? Because I feel like...
After the fact, obviously, okay. I do. I know exactly what you're asking. And that is to say, if you're running this in your mind, was it an unreasonable decision to shoot? I don't think that it was. I think that he did not know that the kid didn't have a gun in his hand as he turned around. It turned out to be a bad decision. In retrospect, it was a bad decision. In retrospect, he didn't need to shoot him. But you don't have that luxury when you are a police officer chasing somebody and they're wheeling around and you think they might have a gun in their hand. You have to make a decision. In his case, it was in 0.8 of a second between the time he began to turn, he let go of the gun and he turned around and the shot was fired. So, I mean, you can second guess it all you want, but you have to ask yourself, and this goes more to what Kim Fox decided, which is this was not a criminal act on Stillman's part. It was a regrettable act. I'm sure if you asked him today, do you regret that? Of course, I'm sure he regrets it with all his heart that he wished he hadn't shot. But put yourself back in that situation and you say, well, was it a reasonable act? Yes, I think it was reasonable. And was it a criminal act? No, it wasn't. I thought that was fairly obvious as soon as we saw the dash cam and slowed it down and saw what was going on. So,
but that's where it gets gray, too, isn't it? Because the next day, the Tribune has a freeze frame, or one of those days, the Tribune has a freeze frame of the instant where Toledo, the 13-year-old boy, has dropped the gun and he's turning towards the police officers with what, for a microsecond, is his hands up, unarmed. But remember, he drops the gun, he turns and he puts his hands up and he is shot all in 0.8 of a second. And yet you look at that picture all day long and the TV stations capture that and freeze frame that. And then it looks like, holy crap, the cop shot an unarmed kid. And that's not a fair presentation of the choice the officer had to make. I'm still ticked about that scene because I just think the media gravitates to this narrative, and the facts in that case were not the same. It wasn't a Laquan McDonald.
I am glad I add a state's attorney to the list of jobs that I never want, right? Someone that could make you so angry one day and made a certain group so angry with her op-ed the other day after the Jussie Smollett case, and that same people cheering on her decisions the next. It just reminds us all to realize that politicians, prosecutors, attorneys, you're going to agree with them one day and hate them the next
day. I thought she was probably getting booed both days, John, just different groups. Right?
Different groups,
I mean,
exactly.
She, you cannot win if you're Kim Fox. When I saw that, I thought people were going, oh, well, Kim Fox, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, I think she made the right call here today, guys. But the lady can't win. About the Jussie Smollett decision, I don't know. Did we talk about that last week in this podcast, Eric?
We didn't, John, because it was on Thursday and we recorded on Wednesday. So we actually haven't talked about it.
So Kim Fox said that it was a hoax and a sham of a prosecution because, remember, her office had already signed off on it. And then the special prosecutor was appointed. The special prosecutor looked at it and found different and also investigated Kim Fox's handling of the case, too. So the day all this goes down in Chicago, Kim Fox has an op-ed in the Sun-Times, and she rips the whole process and makes it very personal. She says, this is what happens to black female prosecutors or to state's attorneys. which she can make that case. I don't think we're talking about that right now, though. But boy, she sure made it about her.
Yes, but I did read the whole thing, and she mentioned other situations where that has been, or she argues has been the case. And I read a little into it, and it did make me think. If we all think a little bit more about some of these things, at least maybe some of our biases are gone. So while I still disagreed with her overall point, I appreciated the point that she made.
I don't know if anybody else dealt firsthand with this story. I did. I talked to her office at the outset of this. The PR end of that, which seemed to be the most important thing, if you looked at any of the emails that were and texts that were FOIA'd, public records requests made by reporters, you can see that the PR angle of this was more important than getting sort of to the heart of why she dropped the case, which is why she's ticked off, because obviously the case was picked up again after she dropped it because of the special prosecutor. Had she just been able to, or her team had been able to communicate accurately what was happening, why the decision was made to drop this case, she would have been having to even spend time worrying about writing this op-ed. It was a mess. You know, I don't, we're not going to charge him after sort of saying, well, you know, I'm recusing myself, but I didn't really recuse myself. That's what she said initially. And then all of this back and forth and sort of, well, no, this is what we mean. We said this, but this is what we mean. And all these explainers for why this case was dropped. I don't know if I want my tax dollars spent on something like this. This seemed to be something everybody wanted to hold on to because he's an actor.
Well, she made that case in that op-ed, and I think we would agree with her on that, right? That it wasn't.
Yes. This became a PR nightmare of her office's making. And I wish she'd own it, and I wish she would just explain really why the case was dropped in legal terms.
Yes, I totally agree, Lisa. And if you want to look at a mess, look at the interview that Fox gave to Meg Crapeau, Greg Pratt, and Jason Meisner at the Tribune shortly after the sentencing came down, right around the same time her op-ed was launching in the Sun-Times. And her explanations don't even track. Like, they'll say, like, they asked her, like, well, at one point you said we didn't have the evidence, and then you said we did have the evidence. Which is it? And she said something like, well, both can be true. And it's just, she has never, ever had her story straight. Kim Fox has never had her story straight on what happened in this case, why she dropped the charges. And she's the one who really helped blow this thing up. Because if she had just let her office prosecute the case, get a confession, Smollett would have paid a small fine. He would have done a couple weeks of community service. It would have been 3 years ago. No one would remember this. He would be well on the way to rehabilitating his career. And yet right now he is sitting in jail, which is sort of odd. He's sitting in jail for orchestrating this hoax.
You think he would have confessed 3 years ago? I mean, look at
No. I think they should have at least made that a condition of him walking free. I totally get that you don't want to waste too much time prosecuting these cases, but you can't let a very high profile defendant just say, walk out of court and say, you know, I'm first of all, he walked out of court and said, I'm innocent. This proves I was being persecuted and railroaded. These charges are false. When in fact, everyone kind of knew that he had cooked this up.
I think we all, that's why we hang on to it. We want him to say, I'm sorry. We want him to admit that it's true. And the fact that he never does every step of the way is the only reason the story keeps on going. It's his fault. We can all be mad at, I don't know, police, Kim Fox, what happened, what didn't Dan Webb. We should all just focus our anger on the one person who concocted this and will never, ever apologize.
Okay, but you're assigning something. You're turning him into a bad guy when we don't even know what his state of mind is. I mean, that fine if you want to be mad at him or whatever else.
You mean when he concocted the thing that night in January? What his state of mind was then?
Then, now, whenever.
You're suggesting that maybe he's not mentally well?
Somebody who's well would not cook something like this up. Yes.
Oh, wow.
You don't think so?
I laughed at that, right? Because it just seems so sympathetic to the guy and I don't like him. But you're right. I mean,
I don't think it's sympathetic. I guess I'm trying to sort of present a couple of dimensions here.
I know that, and it's so preposterous.
We're saying here in this here, let's be mad at him. He's malevolent, and he did this. We don't know. We don't know why he did this. Is I guess what I'm saying.
Well, he didn't not guilty by reason of insanity. The jury, they did find him guilty. I mean, for all intents and purposes, what's the matter?
John,
with
I know you love your rules, and there's a stop sign, and you got to stop at it. But I'm telling you. They're fine. This is the route that they took. They didn't do an insanity case. It doesn't mean that there isn't something wrong there.
But I'm Lisa, I am like the most forgiving person in the world. I just want him to say I'm sorry. For me, it still makes me so upset. And I just try and figure out why. And it's not even the crime anymore. It's not even, you know, maybe he was messed up and there's some real hardships of being a celebrity and being a black gay celebrity. Okay, I'll hear that. Just say you did it, and I'll hear anything.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, fine. I'm just saying that there could be different parts that we don't know about, and so I try to sort of hit the brakes on sort of he's a bad guy, like you, and he's malevolent, and he meant to do this. Because
at the risk of sounding
really
like Kim Fox, it could be both. mean... It could be,
but I do not think we would be there without this PR mess. And that is the string, the theme that runs through all of these politicians. They have these big PR operations and it's become a cluster of sorts.
Well, you're absolutely right, Lisa, because if Kim Fox's PR office had their ear to the ground or their finger to the wind 3 years ago, they wouldn't have dropped this case and would have been a huge favor to Jussie Smollett. To have forced him into a guilty plea, a fine, some community service, whatever, or even forced him to trial because it would be all over by now and he would not have had this spectacle in courtroom where he's conjuring up gay history and black history and raising his fist in the air. And I'm trying to imagine what his future is going to be now. I'm thinking reality TV next, right?
Dancing with the Stars.
Oh.
That's where you go to get rehabbed. Your PR,
what was that? I'm a celebrity. They'll revive
all of the people
they'll
who
revive
have,
that I'm a celebrity, get me out of here.
Somebody said that on the radio the other day. It might have been John Hansen, and I thought that's where he will surface next, because they'll do those little backstory videos and he'll tell this he'll Robin Roberts the thing all over again, and the next thing you know we'll go, he's not such a bad guy, and then
or run for Senate.
God.
Speaking of the way Chicago police handle things, several hundred of the city's police employees have not been vaccinated as of Sunday, the no-pay deadline for city employees. The mayor's plan is now to give them one last chance, mister, to get that vaccine by this coming Sunday, and then after that it's no pay. Ironically, all this comes at a time when the issue is nearly moot. We asked our listeners if they think the city should dock the pay of those officers and city employees immediately, or wait until Sunday, give them that one last chance, or drop the notion entirely. Most of our listeners in our non-scientific click survey, they got several hundred votes, though, said they should dock their pay immediately. That was the line in the sand.
I think your listeners are rule followers, the people who stop at stop signs, aren't they? Mm-hmm. But seriously, I feel like it is like bad parenting 101 to give your kid an ultimatum. Now, I don't want to say that police officers are children, but this is authority relationship, that when you make a deadline, you set a rule, you have to stick with it unless circumstances utterly change. You say that circumstances have changed, but we're still in this pandemic and we're still in a situation where it's much, much better to be vaccinated than not. And so once they set up that requirement, I think they have to follow through. And I'm of a mixed mind about this, because right now, the Chicago Police Department is losing officers at a rather alarming rate, that the number of retirements and resignations is just through the roof. And so if you have a couple dozen officers just like taken off duty, that's not good for public safety. So this is not an abstract question, as far as I'm concerned, but I do think that when you have a deadline like that and you consider it important enough to lay down the law, you can't erase the line in the sand and keep moving it.
Members of the city council said today, John, that, well, actually they gathered. Lori Lightfoot gathered. Wouldn't attend because that was going to be a sham, too. Boy, she never misses a chance to kick up some dust, Lori Lightfoot. But then when they did meet.
Gosh, and I don't really know if they had an end goal there.
Well, they wanted to make it so that nobody would lose their pay. They said it's too dangerous to not continue to employ these city employees, so they were going to try and override that somehow.
Do you think there's like a solution in the middle, like docking pay by a third? I mean, like, you start really affecting people's paychecks. That might be, how much have we talked about money being the motivating factor for getting people to do it? Why don't you try it gradually first? Why don't you try a 33% pay cut, see if you get another 5%, then you go down to 50%. And then you go to termination. I know that doesn't quite follow up, but there is a point about how our positivity rates, what, less than 1%. Not saying it'll stay there, not saying that there couldn't be another variant that's going to wreck us and focus it again, but I do feel like a gradual approach might actually get more people into compliance, and there, you didn't have to fire anyone.
Well, they've gradually been trying to get this done for a year, right? I mean, they haven't offered him those little cherries along the way, but I mean, they've had plenty of time to come to terms with this, right, John?
Right, but if they have a third or less of their money coming in and they see that coming in on their paycheck, I don't know what would happen. Why can't you try that for 2 weeks? Then try half.
You sound like Joe Biden. You sound like Joe Biden in Russia. It's like, okay, we're going to do a little bit of this, see if it works, and we're going to do a little bit more and see if it works.
I take that as a compliment, so take that.
Well, I'm not against Joe Biden, but I mean, I'm with Eric on this. You're police officers. You should understand the consequences of the law. And if you break the law, they don't go, all right, we're going to put you in jail for a little while. No, you go to jail or you pay the fine.
But what's your end goal? Your end goal is to have as many police as you can, as vaccinated as they can be. Okay, how do you get there, right? You fire them all, you're going to be down a couple thousand police officers, a couple hundred police officers. You stop paying them. Maybe that is what leads them to eventually get into compliance. So I get where that feels good to feel that way, but in the actual reality of running a city with a huge crime problem, the more gradual approach may actually get the answer you want.
Okay, that's a question for Eric. So what do you do now, Eric? We got fewer officers on the beat because you're playing hardball.
That is a dilemma. And I kind of like John's solution, but I don't think the union would go for it for a second, which is an obstacle there. I think this is something that they should have thought this through when they set the ultimatum. But once you set the ultimatum, all of a sudden you lose all your authority, and that's also very dangerous. All of a sudden you have a police department or city employees who don't take you seriously, and you have to, when you set these policies up, you have to be willing to follow through with them, even though it's going to be tough. You know, like I said, I think you have to do it, because otherwise, you know, you're setting yourself up for a lot of hurt later on down the line.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on that, and I don't like the outcome of that. It's not like, oh, good, we got our way, we won. It's like, oh, crap, yes, we won, and now we have fewer officers on the street. But that's not my decision. That's the officers' decisions to no longer be on the street. So if there's less, if there are fewer officers on the street and there's more crime as a result, that's not Lori Lightfoot's fault or the city council's fault. That's the police officers' faults.
But that's the mayor and the city council that has to deal with the ramifications, right? Yeah. Like, and I get what you're saying, John. And maybe the hey, you're fired, here's the last day, maybe that will get a lot more officers vaccinated than I realize or think. But when you make it this line in the sand, it almost becomes a righteous cause that people are fighting
well,
for.
Well, it was a righteous cause. And what about this? I don't know that it's going to be. By the way, I roll through stop signs sometimes, just so you know.
I hate all of you.
But
really,
here's the
do.
Thing. So what about the next time? And maybe it's not a pandemic, maybe it's something else. But what about the next time that the city has to issue an ultimatum to its employees for who knows what? Boy, here's a precedent for you. I mean, they would probably call it out if they said, well, okay, you enforced it here, but you didn't to the cops. I mean, you have, like Eric said, you have no power anymore if you cave on this thing.
Maybe. I think it's really hard to come up with another example that matches this one. I mean, you might be right, but I don't think we're dealing with 5-year-old kids here. I imagine some people listening right now are saying perhaps we are, but I don't think that it's one of those precedent setters. This is a really unusual, unique situation. I still think that for the most part, police officers are going to follow the orders of their commanders and of their mayor, regardless if she has to walk this one back a little bit in the effort of safety.
Well, she's not good at that. This is one of those instances where people are going, this is how I raised my kids. Actually, this is how I should have raised my kids. All of us, in fact, caved on our kids. But we know that that's how it's supposed to be.
And you're turning this car around right now.
I know. I'll come back there, so help me. And they never came back there. As we sit here today, though, we are a few days away from Sunday. So then Sunday, some people are going to not get paid, essentially lose their job, right? If they don't comply, the goal line was moved to Sunday, right?
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Ukraine. It gets worse by the day. The shelling of the Ukrainian cities and civilian areas becomes more and more indiscriminate, or maybe those are the targets that Putin's rockets are aiming for. I have a lot of praise for that Russian journalist, Marina Ovsyannikova. She's the woman who walked behind the newscast on Russia's most watched newscast, and the sign said, "No war." She said, "You're being lied to." It was on their Channel One. She was an editor for that broadcast network. She was arrested and temporarily, they didn't know where she was, but she did show up in court the next day. She does say that she thinks her family is safe. And then she kind of doubled down. She hasn't backed down on what she's been saying. She said people are being lied to and the blood of the Ukrainians is on Putin's hands. Talk about courage, huh?
I think it's also when you see that story, when you see that perhaps as of right now, the Ukrainians have some encouragement that there are some higher level talks that are happening with Russia. I don't know if they're going to go anywhere or not. It makes me appreciate what you mentioned earlier, John, the very measured yet unified approach that the West is taking to this. This very deliberate, economically based sanctions package, as well as some weapon systems getting to Ukraine, though not necessarily directly from NATO allies or whatever the case may be, that while it is painful to watch every single day, and there will be people that die needlessly in the next couple of days, that the hope is that by not escalating things too quickly and by taking this somewhat measured approach and a strong approach economically, that this may actually work. And you start to see slowly but surely, the Russians countering. Now, I don't know. That may be me just thinking pie in the sky, but it makes me appreciate the efforts of the Biden administration and the rest of the Western allies.
Although President Biden was just on, I'm sure you saw it, John, was on and indicated that this is going to take some time.
Yeah.
And that it is going to take, suggesting this is going to be a longer road. If you allow sort of everybody psychologically, whatever, to refuel, I don't know what happens. I'm concerned that the longer this goes, and this whole idea of kind of just surrounding these cities and strangling them, you know, by not letting supplies in, whether it's food or water.
It's painful for the Russian side, too, though. They're losing a lot of soldiers. They're losing a lot of money. They've reached out to China for arms and assistance. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, I don't think China's going to help them out very much. I don't think China sees the instability that Russia is causing to be in their long-term economic interests.
No.
I get the sense from Zelensky that he is not, I mean, he wants to win. In other words, he wants back to status quo before the invasion. And he's not going to accept, I don't think right now his posture is he doesn't want to accept any kind of negotiated settlement like you take this region, you take that region, and we'll be all square now, or we'll sign a document that says we will never join NATO. He feels like if you encourage Russia at all with any concessions, you're just enabling future incursions, future invasions that you really have to, we really have to, Ukraine and the rest of the Western world has to stand up to this aggression and has to stop it and has to have there be no reward for it. You don't want to give Putin a reward for the invasion. And he's certainly sounding a very defiant tone. And I'm wondering whether Biden is meeting the moment, whether the West is meeting the moment and realizing that we need to continue to up the sanctions. We need to continue to get more weapons in the hands of Ukrainians. We need to make sure that these attacks that are really close to the Polish border don't accelerate. That there can't be any sense of progress by Russia. This has to be going in the proper direction. And I do think the stakes seem very high here, and that we can't act like, oh, this is just a skirmish over there in a land far away. This is something that is threatening the entire Western alliance if we don't put a stop to it.
It's also strengthening the Western alliance too, isn't
100%.
It?
Yes, definitely.
I think they are meeting the moment. I am kind of, I guess, surprised, and I think it was because of how much President Biden and the Western leaders telestrated what was happening, that all of the world's attention was already on Russia and Ukraine, so that the moment when the invasion happened, the pump was primed. We were already ready to get around this, and we have. I mean, we were at the United Center last night, and we have a Ukrainian chorus, and the crowd erupts in pro. And Alicia, your point is very valid, though. How long does that last psychologically? But you say, Eric, that you can't give Putin anything. You have to give him a face-saving moment if you want to give him some out, if you're going to save world peace.
Yeah.
And yes, that isn't great for tomorrow, but it gets us through today, right?
Like, what's the off-ramp?
The off-ramp, I don't know. That they're like Finland. They're a neutral country. They promise, maybe not directly, they'll never join NATO, but they're satisfied in their current situation. They'll remain neutral. I don't know. I mean, that's going to have to be Zelensky's decision with his people, knowing what they are willing to accept or not. But we're just trying to save the world today for tomorrow.
Exactly. But doesn't Zelensky sound more emboldened, more defiant,
yeah,
even than ever? I mean, he sounds like he is determined to be the one who pushes back against Putin and sends him back into Russia, and that he's not going to accept, that he wants to destroy that offer. He doesn't want to give him that off ramp. And I think we do have to be a little careful of that too, because John Hansen, you're exactly right. There has to be some way, because Putin seems in some ways kind of deranged, that he does need some sort of way to save face as his army gets destroyed, as it seems to be in most cases, or as he has to pull back there. He needs to save face with his people, because his entire regime is going to be threatened if this turns into the cluster event that it seems to be. So
I don't know that the leader the leader of Ukraine has to sort of stand down. I mean, he's representing his country, has been invaded. I don't know that he necessarily needs to give the off ramp. He's standing up for his people. They're being murdered. They're being, you know, their towns are being taken over. Their homes are being bombed out. I'm not sure that he has to take that stance. I think on the world stage, maybe there could be an off ramp. But right now, this person is you know, in their country with their countrymen, trying to stave off, you know, a coup. And I just don't know that he has to give that off ramp. He's also representing, he's kind of echoing what a lot of countrymen and women are saying too. We're staying, we're not going, you know, this is our home. No one's pushing us out. We're not going to relive World War II or the lead up to World War II. And furthermore, a friend of mine who's a journalist over there, he was the editor of the Kyiv newspaper, which was shuttered in November, and now is the Kyiv Independent. And he returned. He went back. He's family there. And there is just sort of this overwhelming feeling. Yes, a lot of people have fled. If you had small children, I think that would really change your outlook on the world. And you'd want to kind of get them out of there. But a lot of people have stayed behind. And there was a mayor of one of the districts who said, you know, everyone's sort of seeing these pictures of things being bombed out. But and I know that there are some places that are absolutely devastated, but we're also able to go to an ATM. We are going to continue living our lives here. You know, we can go to the grocery store for now. This is our home. We're mm-hmm. not going to be pushed out.
And I think that Biden is being too hesitant in not allowing for the transfer of fighter jets to Ukraine. There's this deal where the Poles were going to give the Ukrainians their fighter jets, and the Americans were going to replace the fighter jets for Poland. This is like kind of one of those sports deals where one be three-way trade.
Yeah.
And it seemed like
a weapon to be named later.
Yeah, exactly. See,
and it seemed like a really good idea. And Biden seems very hesitant about escalation and worried about escalating it with acts like that. I can understand where you might not want to engage in a full-scale escalation of this conflict, but Putin is escalating it every day. As Lisa points out, people are being murdered over there. Civilians are being shelled in their apartment buildings and children's hospitals. And these are war crimes that are occurring. And we're acting like, oh, we don't want to make him any madder than he is. At some point, you have to say, like, maybe we're not going to send our own troops over there, but we're going to supply them with the best weapons we have and the best support we can possibly give them, because they seem to be a very capable fighting force if you give them the tools. And the Russians seem to be a really bad fighting force. Neil Steinberg has a great column in this morning's Sun Times about how their tanks are just all over Ukraine because they've got the wrong weapons in the wrong places, and it's very funny. It's funny how badly they're fighting, I should say. So I think we need to step up all the aid we can without actually putting our boots on the ground over there.
Did any of you see the Zelensky address to the U.S. Congress today?
Yes.
If this is too much to ask, we offer an alternative. You know what kind of defense systems we need.
And what was your reaction to the video that they presented?
I thought it was powerful. I mean, to show, like, this is what it was a month ago. And this is what these bombed out buildings, you know, they were showing before and after, you know,
and during. Yeah, you saw buildings
during,
just blowing up.
Murdered children.
Yeah. You saw blood.
It was disturbing and it was necessary.
I thought the speech was interesting. His allusions to Pearl Harbor, 9/11, and Martin Luther King.
He quoted MLK.
Yeah.
Which is strange. Not strange, sorry. It kind of came out of nowhere for me. I thought the video was impactful. I think a lot of people have seen some of these images before. I thought the music was a little strange. It almost felt like, do you guys remember when in the Trump administration they would play videos for
reporters?
Completely.
I drew that analogy on my show today, John.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
It was a packaged message with I'm sorry. I thought it was a little ham-handed. I thought it was a little over the top. I mean, so what was the point then that we would be so moved by this emotional video that what? We're going to do something we know we shouldn't do, which is engage with Russian planes over Ukraine. We're not going to do that. So except that it made everybody feel awful, I don't think it was as manipulative, if you will, as they intended
it to be. I think he knew his audience.
Do you think his audience was just Congress? I don't.
Good point. Go ahead, John. You were saying.
I think what he was realizing is that he was going to have a large audience, and it felt odd to me. But if it got 10 more people to care, then what do I care?
I really don't know how you deliver a perfect speech when your country's being shelled. I actually thought he had done his homework pretty well. Representatives, go back home and tell businesses to stop doing business with Russia. And I thought, well, okay. And
I love that version of the war, or that part of the war. I love that. It's what a stupid way to put it. But I'm intrigued by, I'm pleased that these non-state actors, these companies and these platforms are also punishing Russia. Mm-hmm. And by the way, there's some pushback there. Some companies who have a huge interest in Russian commerce. What was it? 70% of all the shaving products in Russia are made by Gillette. And they don't like the fact that we're telling them not to sell to that huge population. And so the CEO of that company said this week, you know, it's not our place to fight this war. And then there's companies that sell things that they say are for humanitarian purposes. Yeah. So all big pharma now gets to continue to distribute goods there. And I'm not even sure I support that.
Pharma is one thing, because these are, you know, this is medication taken by people that keeps them alive and keeps them healthy. Shaving equipment is, I think, yet another. I mean, I think if you can punish them, you know, punish them by making them grow their whiskers. I was struck by the line where he talks about, you know, remember Pearl Harbor, remember September 11th. Our country's experienced the same every day right now. And yeah. if we can remember what that was like 21 years ago, September 11th, when how shattered this country was. And you can imagine this happening every single day.
It was one terrible day.
I think it's inexcusable for a company like Gillette to say that they're not going to participate, when you've got Starbucks and McDonald's and all these other companies, and they're not killing the Russian economy by themselves, but it's going to be death by a thousand cuts at the end of the day, I think, for the Russian economy if the world can hold together. especially if China doesn't reach out to help Russia, which, as I said earlier, I don't think is going to happen. I don't think China wants to be in the middle of this. I don't think China wants to be seen as an ally of Putin. You know, the economy of Russia is like the size of the economy of Texas. It's an important oil producing nation, but it's if you want to be a world player the way China does, you don't want to alienate the entire rest of the world so you can be friends with Vladimir Putin.
Right.
I think they may be sitting there in Beijing going, I don't think so. I'm going to sit this one out.
And one of the
they do that in Chinese, by the way, when they do that. They don't say, I don't think so. If they say, I don't think so, then I don't think
so. No, I think they actually speak in English.
Well, I'll bet the one Chinese guy goes to the other guy, I'll bet he doesn't say, I don't think so. I'm sure it's in Chinese.
Okay.
Or Mandarin.
Mandarin, maybe. By the way, here's what they're up against. A friend of mine who's been monitoring Putin in his most recent broadcast says today Putin in a television address called for the self-purification of Russia and for people to hunt down and eliminate traitors. This friend of mine is a professor of government at Benedictine University. He says it is Stalinist in both form and substance. He's seeking to unleash some sort of combination of civil war, great terror, and cultural revolution. He almost sounds like the Nazis that he's accusing some of the people in Ukraine of being when he talks about purification and hunting down the traitors. But that's the way Putin is talking on TV today. Find them, he said, simply spit them out like a fly that happened to fly into your mouth. That's a literal translation.
Sounds desperate.
That's the other thing. If you're just watching this on TV and you keep rooting every day for the Ukrainians, you love little nuggets of like this, where Putin seems desperate, where the tanks are on fire, where the companies are fighting back, and where the will of the Ukrainian people seems to endure. So I'm like, give them $800 million more stuff, Joe Biden. Let's let them keep fighting, because you can't let Putin win, even though in the back of your mind, right, you think Putin's going to win. Putin's going to win. If we're not going to fight this on the ground, Putin will ultimately grind this thing out.
Yes, but at what cost? At what will he have lost at that point? And I think that's ultimately the international game that's being played, is maybe the Ukrainians hold on long enough to force peace talks. Maybe they hold on long enough for the economy of Russia to collapse even more. Or maybe just made you make it so hard that even if he wins, it's not worth winning anymore. And he has to make that calculation. I am going to be so fascinated on what the back channels we'll find out later are diplomatically that is happening.
Who's talking to who right now?
Who's talking to between Russia, China, and the United States? And sometimes when we hear people, and I don't mind when representatives, I heard your interview with Adam Kinziger, which I thought was interesting, and he at least appreciated there's nuance to it. I don't mind when you have lawmakers screaming to do more. I'm okay with Congress being the bad guy and Joe Biden being the good cop and playing a little bit of that off each other. There is something to be said that perhaps they're doing this somewhat concertedly, like they're doing this together.
The U.S. is orchestrating this response bit by bit, pushing Joe Biden to do what everybody else wants him to do.
And Joe Biden may be welcoming some of that vocal pushback. There's a reason why Zelensky spoke to Congress today.
That's costing him and Democrats politically, isn't it, John?
I don't think so. I think a just resolution to this, a good resolution at the end, will help. And I honestly think, and you might just say I'm absolutely crazy, Joe Biden's role model through his entire presidency, long before, has been FDR, who played a very interesting game leading into World War II with a country that didn't want to go to war and that he knew he had to get them there in some way, shape, or form. And he, FDR, utilized Congress in interesting ways too. Maybe that's so pie in the sky. Nothing like that can happen these days. But I think Joe Biden is okay with a one-term presidency if it keeps us out of an escalated World War III. I really think he's okay with that.
Let's do campaign 2022, Eric Zorin. By the way, Lisa, it's 3:30. Are you going to exit stage left?
I'm going to exit now. Thanks for making fun. I mean, good to see you all. And as always,
don't run no stop signs.
Follow those rules, gentlemen.
Okay.
Thanks, Lisa.
Bye.
What's with Lisa? Holy cow. I don't think I'm a super rule. I think my wife would tell you I'm not a big rule follower. I'm a, what do they call it, where you a situational ethicist? Yeah. I always assess things and go, well, I think it's right now for me to do this. Campaign 2022. Eric Zorn, what races are of interest to you this week?
Well, I've been watching this race for Congress and for Bobby Rush's old seat, and I noticed that State Senator Jacqueline Collins of Chicago has jumped into that primary, and she's backed by Father Flager. And the field now includes Jonathan Jackson, who's Reverend Jesse Jackson's son, Chicago Alderman Pat Dowell, who was running for treasurer. No, I'm sorry, she was running for Secretary of State, and she backed out of that race in order to run for this seat. And Rush has endorsed a candidate, Karen Norrington Reeves, Jonathan Swain, who's a former City Hall insider, and activist Jamal Cole. I seem to remember there are now 20 candidates who have submitted petitions to run in that race. So it's going to be just a wide open scrum.
For this Southside congressional seat. Does the name Jackson carry as much import or weight, Eric, as it used to?
I don't think it does. I don't think that Jonathan Jackson is that or Jesse Jackson anymore. Jonathan Jackson is all that well regarded that he's going to clear the field. Name recognition is going to mean a lot. So, you know, Collins and Dowell and all the people, when you have a Jackson name, he might only get like 20% of the vote, but that might be enough. You also see that like Danny Davis has basically no opposition. Lauren Underwood has no opposition in the U.S. Congress.
Really? No one's running against Lauren Underwood?
Not for the primary.
Yeah, I guess so. But will she win her seat anyway, John?
You know, they've redrawn her. She's a little bit more strengthened, I believe.
She's pretty safe, you're saying?
I think she's safer than she was before. It's still a swing district. It might be a tough year for them in 2022.
Let's do this. I just want you guys to comment on the gubernatorial race, too. Jeannie Ives has endorsed Darren Bailey. Darren Bailey is, of course, running in the Republican primary against a few other fellers. And Jeannie Ives was sort of this... finish that sentence for me, John. Jeannie Ives was...
a very conservative... social conservative running against Bruce Rauner in the 18 primary.
And almost pulled it off, yeah.
But she's been a player in the Republican Party for a while.
Yeah.
She had 48% of the vote against Bruce Rauner in that primary, which was pretty stunning given that Rauner was the incumbent governor. And she was just harvesting that socially conservative base Republican vote in a way that was very surprising. We thought for a while she might actually win that race. I think she has a lot of pull, and the fact that she's endorsed Darren Bailey, I think, gives Darren Bailey some juice in this primary. I still think he may be the guy to beat.
Yeah, you do.
I'm not sure that Richard Irvin is gaining traction with the kind of voters who are going to turn out for a Republican primary. Richard Irvin would probably do better against J.B. Pritzker in a general election, but in a primary, I'm not sure that he's going to beat Darren Bailey.
Don't you think this thing coming from a mile away? So this Darren Bailey, this downstate conservative knucklehead who got dragged out of the assembly because he wouldn't wear a mask, but he can garner all of these votes, especially with a Jeannie Ives maybe endorsing him, although she's not his running mate. And Richard Irvin just seems to be milquetoast. So then Bailey wins the primary. Bailey in a million years wouldn't beat J.B. Pritzker. I mean, the system is sort of set up to fail if you are a Republican in this state.
Yes, my mind agrees with everything you're saying, but I remember so many people saying, Democrats, oh man, Donald Trump is the best opponent you could ever want. And I'm not saying Darren Bailey is Donald Trump.
No, I get it. I know.
You know what I'm saying?
He's 100%.
He's that loose, free talking. I'll say anything I want to anybody. Now, I don't know if that's the magic bullet, but 22, this is going to be a weird year. And it could be a very red year. So I don't know. But I think you're right still.
The analogy might be Alan Keyes, though. Remember?
That was a different
deranged
world.
Conservative.
Boy, that was pre-Trump. A different world. That was pre-Trump. I mean, you're right, John. I think that whole shoot from the hip kind of the crazier the better, that still has some cachet, doesn't it?
We'll see.
One last thing, fellas. Daylight saving, standard time. John Hansen, go.
I'm so sick of hearing about it. So my idea is in the fall, let's go back a half hour and never talk about this again, because it seems to be split. I like having the later sunrise in the winter and that the sun wouldn't come out till 8:15, but I don't love it enough to keep on fighting about it. So let's split,
there you go.
Split the difference and I'll move on with our lives.
This came out of nowhere, didn't it? This is a subject that gets talked about every 6 months, usually on God bless you guys on radio talk shows, right?
Yeah,
you
sure.
And then suddenly the U.S. Senate passes this resolution unanimously, this bill unanimously. I like the idea of standardizing it one way or the other. I kind of like daylight saving because I like how late the evenings are, and I'm not an early morning person generally. And when I am an early morning person, I don't mind it being dark out. I don't send kids to school in the dark, so maybe I shouldn't have a voice in this. But I would like us to pick one and be there. If we want to do the half hour thing that Hansen recommends, then I'm all for that too. I think I would just like us to settle on a time and keep it.
This will mean that on Christmas Day, the sun would not come up until 8:30 in Chicago. And in some places in the western part of the time zone, it would be closer to 9 o'clock before the sun comes up on Christmas Day. John, are you willing to hoist that on America?
Yes. No. So if I were to actually have my druthers, I'd say leave it as it is. You know why? I hate monotony. I love the event of watching the clocks change. It's something different. It's exciting. The hour just came. We just went from 5:58 p.m. as the sun set to 7:02. How cool is that? I like it. That's like when it snows 2 feet. That doesn't happen a lot. That's pretty cool. I like breaking it up.
Plus, how would we know when to change the batteries in our smoke alarms if we didn't have this thing every 6 months? But, you know, the interesting thing, as I understand it, fellas, is that if Congress passes this bill, it's passed the Senate, then it'll be up to the states. So you could still have the situation where, while your state would be one or the other, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, we might not all be aligned. You know what I mean? That complication doesn't change, where one state would be in standard time and one would be in daylight saving time.
Oh, I hate that. I mean, I hate it when you go down through Indiana and parts of Michigan and you don't know when your clock is supposed to change.
Yep.
The way I read the bill, I thought the same thing, John, but I reread it. It seems to be that the states that were already exempt, because there are two states, I think it was Arizona and another one, they would remain to have the autonomy to choose, but the rest of us would have to standardize.
So oh, I see. Really? Wow.
It carved out an exception that the states that are already exempt from the rules or exempt from mandating it, they could still choose what they wanted, but the rest of us would still be on the same thing. That was my interpretation.
Who reads the bills? You actually read these things?
Well, I was so it came out of nowhere. I was like, where the hell did this come from? And also, everyone's saying it passed unanimously. That's a technicality. No one raised their hand and said, I object, because no one's in the damn building. So.
Don't take that away from me. That's the one thing. I mean, other than applauding Ukraine, this is the only thing that our Congress has been united on. So let me have that, okay?
Okay, you got
it. That's John Hansen. That's Eric Zorn. Lisa is off following some rules somewhere, so she had to leave to go do her job. We are produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Thanks, friends.
Yeah.
It's good to see you guys again.
Yeah, thanks for popping in here, John. Anytime you can be part of this, we really appreciate it.
I told Pete earlier I was most likely going to, and then when Brandon told me he might have to bid, I dip out, I was like, well, then I'll definitely come in.
Well, thanks for making the effort.
Good to talk to you. So. Yeah.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.